Hello and welcome to today's episode of Rainer on Leadership, your online home for leadership lessons and advice for the local church. I'm your host, Jonathan Howell, and as always, I'm joined by Tom Rainer, the president and CEO of Lifeway Christian Resources.
You're too young to have ever watched the Mickey Mouse Club.
No, it was on whenever I was a kid.
Really? Maybe a second version of it?
A different version.
Not Annette Funicello?
No, no, no. She was from like the movies that, you know, Frankie and Annette. I know who she is.
Okay. Well, she was one of the—
Back in the day.
Back in the day. Yeah. And they would have this kind of, we're going to have a special guest star today. And we'd always get excited about who the guest star was. And it never was anybody that was special. Are you wondering why I'm saying this?
I'm just waiting. Is today a special episode? Is that what you're saying?
What I'm saying, we have special guests today, not interviews.
Oh, no.
But we have people who are asking questions. And so can we pause for a minute and maybe sing a jingle?
No.
Okay. Well, can we pause for a moment and thank Vanderblumen for being our sponsor?
We can do that.
There we go.
Vanderblumen Search Group, our friends over there, they help churches and ministries build great teams by finding their key staff. But did you know they also have a ton of resources around team building? The newest addition is the Culture Tool, a free comprehensive staff engagement survey to help you build, run, and keep a great team. Check it out at theculturetool.com and be on the cutting edge of this new tool that will help you improve your church staff culture. Once again, that is theculturetool.com to learn more.
Okay, you've got to vouch for me. I think the listeners have at least a level of trust factor with me. I have not seen, nor do I know, what the questions are going to be. Put it in front of me.
And then I realized what I did, and I took it.
But I didn't look at a thing because I'm kind of preoccupied on something else
as you
put it down. So just to let you know, I don't know what the questions are that are coming, so we'll see how I handle them. And here's the good news. If I really mess up, edit.
Yeah, well, we got an editor. So, yeah, that works.
Hope I won't.
Yeah. You never do, Dr. Rainer.
I certainly
perfect
do.
Answers.
Certainly.
All right, so we got a smattering of questions today. Some of them we've kind of touched on.
I have
before.
Not heard smattering in quite a while.
Bringing it back.
Yeah. How is the smattering? That's good.
Okay.
That's good.
So,
did you hear me in chapel talk about my five words?
Yes, which were actually four.
Four?
I was like, well, he meant the core values are five words.
I really don't. I think
totally
I
totally whiffed on that one.
Yeah, you can make excuses for me, but I'll said five instead four.
All right, so we've got a
biblical question. Solutions for life is our
words.
Vision statement. Biblical solutions for life. Those five words. That's what I said in chapel today. Oh gosh, so stupid. Okay, what's the first question?
All right, it's from Pam. And she says, on podcast 390, which was—
I remember that one.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't.
I'm sure you do. It's about 2-3 months ago that we mentioned the rise of networks. She would like some detail about various networks and how they're utilized for the strength and growth of the church.
Networks refer to an informal alliance of churches, as opposed to an alliance of churches that has a more formal structure, like a denomination or a quasi-denomination, like the Southern Baptist Convention, where you still have congregational government. Networks are usually loosely aligned around a broader doctrinal base. So, for example, Baptists will always have immersion baptism in their doctrine statement, but usually, not all the time, the networks have a broader evangelical statement. One of the more common ones would be based upon the Lucan Covenant, if they want to look that one up, and that can give you an idea of what a broad doctrinal statement is, around some type of common theme or purpose. If you go back in years, you could look at, say, the Willow Creek Association, and the Willow Creek Association would have people who were gathered around a broad statement of doctrinal statements. Some would say it's too broad. Some would say it was not. And their common purpose basically was reaching unchurched people, and that was their primary theme. It ended up talking about the style of worship and seeker and all that, but that was the common thing. Then you go back to about that same time. There were a lot of churches that were calling themselves purpose-driven, and that was a network of churches that may or may not have been denominationally aligned. Then you get on the Reform side, and a lot of people talk about being a nine marks church. We hold to these nine doctrinal marks, and we're going to do church the way that nine marks does. So when you begin to talk about a network, you're beginning to talk about a loose alignment. Now, Pam, it's a very good question for more than one reason. First, it's a very good question just because you're asking for clarification, which I appreciate you letting us do. Secondly, it's a very good question because I see us moving in that direction. Yeah. Do I see all denominations dying? No, but most denominations are struggling. We've already talked about that. And I see more networks forming. Acts 29 is another example. Yeah. More Reformed, church planting is their primary emphasis. I think we will see the rise of more and more networks as either a secondary identifier or a primary identifier of churches. In some cases, it will be their denomination, and I'll put that in air quotes that you probably cannot see because I didn't even do them here, or it will be secondary to their denomination, one of the two, sometimes equal to it. But good question. That is one of the trends that I see in the larger church picture all around the world, not just North America.
A question on this. With denominations, there's a little bit more rigidity of membership.
Right.
With networks, seems a bit more fluid.
Yeah, it is.
Do networks kind of rise and fall on whether pastors stay or go and get their new church to move into the network and things like that?
Yeah.
Doesn't there seem to be a little bit more, I guess risk is the right word, but—
Yeah, definitely, sure. Which I love.
Okay.
Because what that means is the network is no longer accomplishing a purpose for which the churches can identify and grasp, it goes away.
You got to earn your keep.
You got to earn your, you can't just say you're in the structure, you're paying the dues, and you have to stay. So I like that about networks, that they are more fluid, and therefore they're more likely to be shorter term than denominations.
All right. Or longer term and more effective.
Could be if they decide to stay.
All right. Yep. Next question's from Dan. I see in the scriptures that the early church was led by a plurality of elders. There seemed to be no quote unquote senior pastors in the early churches. In your opinion, must a church have a senior pastor? If so, should that person have greater influence over the other pastors and elders? And what are the benefits and drawbacks of equally shared authority and influence shared among a plurality of elders in a local church?
So this Dan?
Yes.
Okay. Dan, you're first of all, you're asking a polity question.
Yes.
And depending upon to whom you speak, you're going to get some type of firm answer about this is the right polity. There would be some who would say an elder-led form of government or an elder government, whatever type of descriptor, is the only way according to Scripture. Another would say, no, we need to have a single person, a lead pastor, and there really not be another governing body except the congregation. That's called congregationalism. I would say this. It's hard to get away in Scripture from plurality of leadership. So as I look through Scripture, am I advocating a certain polity? No. But what I am saying is the Scripture leans towards strongly that there should not be lone ranger leadership.
Yeah, autocratic.
Autocratic. Yeah. That there is some type of input that is taking place.
Yeah.
So I affirm plurality of leadership, and I can do that and still embrace elders, deacons, congregationalism. And of course, I'm a part of a denomination that affirms congregationalism, which I still think that you can have plurality of leadership. Sometimes it can occur with the staff. Sometimes we, in congregational governments, we move the deacons to de facto elders by the role that they have. But the simple answer to the question is, I think it is difficult to argue against plurality of leadership. How it manifests itself in a polity is dependent upon the question you ask.
It depends.
It depends there.
Yeah. Yep. One of the drawbacks, so you asked about drawbacks. I would think that in a plurality of elders, the one common drawback that I see at times, it's like the hyper end of it, is that nobody makes a decision.
Yeah. Everybody's in charge, so no one's in charge.
Yeah.
And so usually someone rises to the top, you know, whether it's chairman of the elder board or something like that. But if it does not, you can have some forms of chaos take place.
Yeah, and on the other, it's like the other end of the autocratic is the no-cratic.
No-cratic,
I don't think that's the right word, but yep. I think you get the point.
Yep.
All right, next question is from Jeremy. He says, and this is one we've kind of talked about and touched on before. The treasurer at the church I pastor recently told me that one of our members of our finance committee does not give financially to the church. What do you do in a situation like this, and how do you avoid this from happening in the first place? That the last question is, I think, really key.
Let's go to the last question first, and let's say, how do you avoid it? I think that for certain positions in the church, for simplicity's sake, let's assume maybe it's a nominating committee. Okay, I don't know what you want to call it, and so you got a nominating committee, and they're looking to fill in finance chairman or something similar to that. I think it's incumbent upon the appointive body or person to go to the financial secretary and say, here's our list of potential nominees. Is there any that for stewardship reasons we should not consider, without going to the records and doing so? Yeah. I did that in my last two churches. Rarely did it come back with a red flag. But instead of getting someone someone in a position where they're in a financial leadership position or other leadership position and they're not given to the church, and then you have to deal with it, it's better just to have someone who's looking at the record say they meet, as best we can tell, they meet the qualifications from a stewardship point of view. Other part of the question is, what do you do once someone has gotten into it, a position, and they're not giving or they're giving nominally to the church? In that case, if I'm a pastor, I ask someone else to handle it. And that's okay. That's not deflection really? Of responsibility. No.
All right.
I didn't expect that answer. There are times when leadership has to say, I need others to lead alongside me. Okay. And so I would get a peer or someone, a layperson, or depending on polity, elder or deacon, and say, will you go and talk to the financial secretary about this and then go talk to this person about it? That way, there are times where it appears that the pastor is controlling. At times it appears that the pastor's looking at the financial records. It can make some people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. In that case, because I had that, you've heard me talk about that before. I've had that.
He was the chairman, wasn't it?
He was the chairman of the finance committee. Yes. Yeah. And had never given to the church.
In this instance, it looks like it's a member of the finance committee, not the chairman.
I still think it's a disqualifier.
Well, I agree. But I think the appropriate person to go to is the chairman.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Somebody
doesn't need, treasurer or whoever it may be.
Somebody does not need to be determining how the church will steward its funds if they are not a steward of the funds.
Yes, I think.
Yeah. You understood that one. I did too.
If you're not going to be a part of this, then you shouldn't be leading part of this, I guess.
Yeah, I understood mine better.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Next question from Todd. If my church is in a small rural town with other small towns 15 minutes or so down the road, is having multiple sites in other towns a good idea? And how far from the home site do you go?
That depends. Again, it depends on what you. It depends on what you define as community. Okay, let me give an example. Do you know where my first church was? The Church of First Merle,
Southern Indiana. That's all I remember.
Okay, it had an address of Hanover, which is where Hanover College is. It's a small town. That still doesn't mean anything. But the community was called. They pronounced it Volga. It's V-O-L-G-A. But they pronounce it Volga, I think it's a Russian province somewhere, something of that nature.
Okay.
However, if you were to ask people in that rural community where they do business, where they transact, where they connect with other people, where they take their car, where they go to restaurants, that becomes the question of where the community is. And so let's suppose that you have a couple of small or three small towns away. Do they consider themselves a common rural community? So regardless of distance, do they consider themselves a common rural community? Okay, if you feel like that there's a commonality in the rural community, you then ask the question, should we do multi-site in those communities? Probably it would be more likely to do a church acquisition or merger than it would be to start a new church as a second campus there.
Okay.
So if you find that a church is struggling and your church as a rural church is a bit healthier, you may want to go in there and say, can we partner together? Or basically that means, can we acquire you?
Yeah.
And we'll have two campuses, but one manifestation, one church.
All right. So small towns, the last part of it is like how far do you go? I guess obviously, again, just—
It depends on what the community, how far they will go to transact business, their daily merchant. Like at my rural church, most of all of them went to the southern portion of Hanover. And so if I were to draw a custom polygon that would capture my demographics back then, I would have captured about a 2-mile radius around the rural community, and I would have stretched it to the bottom of, to the southern portion of Hanover.
Okay.
Because that's the community. And by the way, that would have been about 8 miles.
Uh-huh.
Going one way.
And 15 miles, I mean, I'm like thinking about around here. I mean, that's 3 or 4 communities.
Oh, 15 miles here could be 10 communities the way we're packed in.
Yep. So, all right. Well, next question from Jason. It says, we struggle like many
Jason
churches.
Allen?
No, different Jason. We'll talk about him later.
Okay.
But he says that we struggle like many churches do to get guests to acknowledge that they are visiting using our communication cards. What are some other ways that we can connect with these guests? We started using recently with greeters in the sanctuary, which has helped some, but we are still missing a large amount of guests.
So I'm assuming that they're not finding out their names.
I guess so.
The way the question is, we've talked about
it's
this before.
Cheers. They don't know their names.
We've talked about the possibility of doing this, and the churches that have success, my church is one of these, are the churches that say, when you fill out a guest card, we're going to give $5 to a local food and clothing ministry here. And then the giving of the card becomes an altruistic motive. That's one of the best ways to capture it. Well, let me say that's the second best way. The best way is to have such outgoing guests, outgoing members in your church. They're going up to them and saying, hey, can I get your name and email? I'd just like to follow up. Not meaning I'm going to do that, but If you have that kind of person and they can do so, absolutely. One of those two.
Huh. So have your greeters or members be in like the guest card themselves. And they get the...
We have someone in our little church like that.
Okay.
And I didn't know that till about a week ago and found that he's absolutely incredible. He'll just go up and start a conversation. Hey, maybe we can get together for coffee. You mind sharing your email with me?
Does he then turn that into the church?
He turns it into the church. I think I need to check on this, but I think he turns it into the church after the second time.
Okay.
So it's just the church.
So it's not like the church is spamming them all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I like that. That's pretty cool.
If they do it.
All right. The next question is from Matthew. Good question right here. As a bivocational pastor, I often get asked the question, so when are you moving to full-time ministry?
Oh, boy.
It even happens in my church from time to time. Well, well-meaning members tell me, well, Lord willing, we'll be able to get you full-time someday. Often, bivocation ministry is looked at as something to try and escape or as a stepping stone to a, quote, real pastorate, rather than being valued as a dual calling. He says he feels a distinct calling to be bivocational. He's a pastor and a public school teacher and feels convinced that God has placed me in both situations. He said, why do Christians and pastors downplay the value of bivocational ministry?
Because they're wrong. And the reality of it is, Matthew, we don't have an easy solution for you. We're not able to say, okay, you need to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and all of a sudden this will fix that issue. Let me give you a kind of a parallel to this. We hear this question sometimes, for example, from student pastors. And the student pastor will say, when are you going to become a real pastor? You know, someone asks them that. And they say, I feel called to student ministry. Or someone may even be an executive pastor. When you think you'll ever want to be promoted to become, you know, a real pastor, a full-time pastor? This is where we stop worrying about what people say. Even if perceptions may hinder our ministry a little bit by our perceived authority, just embrace it. Because here's what's taking place, Matthew. What you are doing is the future. Just wait on it. It'll catch up with you.
Yep.
And it'll catch up with you for a number of reasons. Reason number one is so effective. I look at the number of people that I had the opportunity to share the gospel, and those times when I was bivocational as a pastor were much more plentiful than when I was full-time. My third church was in Louisville, Kentucky. It started off as bivocational. It's actually in Jeffersontown, but it's in Louisville. No, that's right. It was my second church.
Yeah, second
church. I've been bad about it. In case y'all are listening, I have messed up on numbers all day today.
It's like, Matthew, you're adding to the thing.
Yeah, it was my second church, and I started off bivocational. I was working at a bank, and the church grew to the point where they said, well, let's make you a real pastor. And so I went full time. Yeah, I can be a real pastor now. I have to say I was much more effective, especially in the evangelistic end, when I was bivocational. I think that there's return to that, number one, because of how effective it is. And so I would say, Matthew, you're now a bivocational pastor. It won't be long before they start calling you a marketplace pastor. And it'll feel so much cooler.
Just start calling yourself that. You're on the bleeding edge.
And that's a good advice. Hey, I want to tell y'all what I am. I'm a marketplace pastor. Y'all can refer to that because I am in the marketplace to try to have a witness and then also to serve this church. Second reason, fewer churches will be able to afford full-time pastor. So what's happening at Matthew's church is going to be happening at Mark, Luke, and John. No, what's happening what is happening at Matthew's church will become more and more common in other churches. So this trend, I think, it has two-sided coin. First part of the coin is it's healthy because more and more people will be in marketplace ministry. The other side of it is an indicator in some churches that there will be financial problems and stewardship problems. So, Matthew, I cannot give you an answer to make it go away. Just wait for the future to catch up with you, and you will begin to see some things happen.
And what better vocation to be into as well
teacher.
As a than a public school teacher?
Oh.
The opportunities there.
Yeah.
Endless.
Yeah, the influence that Matthew has and will continue to have.
And that his church could have on the school.
Yep.
You know, we've talked a lot about partnering with local schools and how churches can do that. And just having somebody who's in the school already just makes that so much easier for that church to do.
Yeah. You know, I have given the story on more than one occasion about Frank that I had the opportunity to lead to Christ before he died. When did I meet him?
When you worked at the bank.
When I worked at the bank, when I was bivocational. But it took how many years from 1986 to 2016?
30.
Yeah, it took 30 years for me to catch up with Frank.
It's only about a 30-year life.
Oh, gosh. Thank you so much, sir. And while we are talking about things with hyperbole, it's hard to speak with hyperbole about Midwestern, because Midwestern Seminary, they're doing so many great things, it's hard to exaggerate what's going on.
Yeah, their Accelerate program is really killing it right now. Students can earn both a Bachelor of Arts degree and a Master of Divinity degree in just 5 years of intensive study. That's a BA and an MDiv at the same time. This innovative residential program combines rigorous academic training with practical ministry preparation, resulting in one of the most effective programs around, so that you can pursue your ministry calling as soon as possible. Get 2 degrees in 5 years, all from one program, the Accelerate program at Midwestern Seminary. Take the next step by visiting mbts.edu/accelerate. That's going to do it for today's episode of Rainer on Leadership. Any final closing thoughts, Dr. Rainer?
Love episode 406, Q&A from our listeners. Keep those letters and keep those emails, keep those cards, however we're communicating. I don't guess we're getting letters. Jonathan, do they get something for submitting a question?
Yeah, they get a free book.
All right.
And we'll probably, what I will do, because this should be in, we're recording this a few weeks ahead of time, but we should have the new books in.
Okay, my
so
new books.
Send them a copy of Becoming a Welcoming Church.
And let's also send them a copy of We Want You Here, the book that goes to the guests. I think that'd be great. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us here today on Rainer on Leadership. Be sure to subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, or in your favorite podcasting app. And join us online at tomrainer.com, where we are growing healthy churches together.